Nunc Dimittis, read by Jeffrey Palmer.
It is nearly midnight, and I can see that if I don't make a start with writing this story now, I never shall. My idea, and I believe it was a good one, was to try, by a process of confession and analysis, to discover a reason, or at any rate some justification, for my outrageous behaviour towards Janet de Pelagia. If I'm to be quite honest with myself, I suppose I shall have to admit that what is disturbing me most is the knowledge that I have made a monstrous fool of myself, and that all my friends must now be regarding me as nothing but a vicious, vengeful old man. Yes, and that surely hurts. When I say to you that my friends were my whole life, then perhaps you'll begin to understand. Will you? I doubt it, unless I digress for a minute to tell you roughly the sort of person I am. I suppose I am a type. A rare one, mark you, but nevertheless a quite definite type. The wealthy, leisurely, middle-aged man of culture. Adored, I choose the word carefully, by his many friends for his charm, his money, his air of scholarship, his generosity, and I sincerely hope for himself. He is invariably a bachelor, yet he never appears to get entangled with the women who surround him, who love him so dearly. I don't think I need say more. You should know me well enough by now to judge me fairly, and, dare I hope it, to sympathise with me when you hear my story. You may even decide that much of the blame for what has happened should be placed not upon me, but upon a lady called Gladys Ponsonby. After all, it was she who started it. Had I not escorted Gladys Ponsonby back to her house that night nearly 6 months ago, and had she not spoken so freely to me about certain people and certain things, then this tragic business could never have taken place. We had been dining with the Ashendons, and when it was time to go, I offered to see her safely back to her house. She accepted, and we left together in my car. But unfortunately, when we arrived at her place, she insisted that I come in and have one for the road. I didn't wish to be stuffy, so I told the chauffeur to wait and followed her in. Gladys Ponsonby is a widow, a few years younger than me, maybe 53 or 54. And it is possible that 30 years ago she was quite a fetching little thing, but now the face is loose and puckered, with nothing distinctive about it whatsoever. The individual features, the eyes, the nose, the mouth, the chin, are buried in the folds of fat around the puckered little face, and one does not notice them, except perhaps the mouth, which reminds me, I cannot help it, of a salmon. In the living room, as she gave me my brandy, I noticed that her hand was a trifle unsteady. The lady is tired, I told myself, so I mustn't stay long. We sat down together on the sofa and for a while discussed the Ashendons' party and the people who were there. Finally, I got up to go. "Lionel, tell me what you think of my new portrait." She indicated a large canvas hanging over the fireplace that I had been trying to avoid with my eye ever since I entered the room. It was a hideous thing. Painted, as I well knew, by a man who was now all the rage in London, a very mediocre painter called John Royden. It was a full-length portrait of Gladys, Lady Ponsonby, painted with a certain technical cunning that made her out to be a quite alluring creature. "Charming," I said. "Listen, Lionel, John Royden is so sought after now that he won't even consider painting anyone for less than 1,000 guineas. "Really?" "Oh, yes. And everyone's queuing up, simply queuing up to get themselves done." "Most interesting." She sat silent for a while, sipping her brandy, and I couldn't help noticing how the unsteadiness of her hand was causing the rim of the glass to jog against her lower lip. She knew I was watching her, and without turning her head, she swiveled her eyes and glanced at me cautiously. "A penny for your thoughts." Now, if there is one phrase in the world I cannot abide, it is this. It gives me an actual physical pain in the chest, and I began to cough. Come on, Lionel, a penny for them. I shook my head, being quite unable to answer. She turned away abruptly and placed the brandy glass on a small table to her left. And the manner in which she did this seemed to suggest that she felt rebuffed and was now clearing the decks for action. I waited, rather uncomfortably, in the silence that followed, and because I had no conversation left in me, I made a great play about smoking my cigar, studying the ash intently and blowing the smoke slowly towards the ceiling. There was beginning to be something about this lady that I did not like, a mischievous brooding air that made me want to get up quickly and go away. When she looked around again, she was smiling at me slyly with those little buried eyes of hers, but the mouth, just like a salmon's, was absolutely rigid. "Lionel, I think I'll tell you a secret. I'm not very good at secrets. I suppose you know that John Royden paints only women." "I didn't." "And they're always full-length portraits, either standing or sitting, like mine here. Now, take a good look at it, Lionel. Do you see how beautifully the dress is painted? Well, go over and look carefully, please." I got up, reluctantly, and went over and examined the painting. To my surprise, I noticed that the paint of the dress was laid on so heavily it was actually raised out from the rest of the picture. It was a trick, quite effective in its way, but neither difficult to do nor entirely original. "You see," she said, "it's thick, isn't it, where the dress is?"
"Yes."
"But there's a bit more to it than that, you know, Lionel. I think the best way is to describe what happened the very first time I went along for a sitting."
"Oh, what a bore this woman is," I thought, "and how can I get away?"
"That was about a year ago. Mr. Royden sat me down, gave me a drink, and came straight to the point. He told me about how he painted quite differently from other artists. In his opinion, he said, there was only one method of attaining perfection when painting a woman's body, and I mustn't be shocked when I heard what it was. You see," he went on, "you examine any painting you like of a woman, I don't care who it's by, and you'll see that although the dress may be well painted, there is an effect of flatness about the whole thing, as though the dress were draped over a log of wood, because the painters themselves didn't really know what was underneath." Gladys Ponsonby paused to take a few more sips of brandy. "Don't look so startled, Lionel," she said to me. "There's nothing wrong about this. So then Mr. Royden said, 'That's why I insist on painting my subjects, first of all, in the nude.'" "Good heavens, Mr. Royden," I exclaimed. "And when I've done you like that," he went on, "we'll have to wait a few weeks for the paint to dry. Then I paint you in your underclothing, and when that's dry, I paint on the dress. You see, it's quite simple." "The man's an absolute bounder," I cried. "Oh, don't be silly, Lionel. Anyway, let me finish. The first thing I told him was that my husband, who was alive then, would never agree. 'Your husband need never know,' he answered. 'Why trouble him? No one knows my secret except the woman I've painted.' And when I protested a bit more, he said, 'My dear Lady Ponsonby, there's nothing immoral about this. Art is only immoral when practiced by amateurs. It's the same with medicine. You wouldn't refuse to undress before your doctor, would you?' I told him I would if I'd gone to him for earache. That made him laugh. But he kept on at me about it, and I must say he was very convincing. So after a while, I gave in. And that was that." She got up and went over to fetch herself some more brandy. "Gladys, is this really true?" "Of course it's true." "You mean to say that's the way he paints all his subjects?" "Yes.
And the joke is the husbands never know anything about it. All they see is a nice, fully clothed portrait of their wives.
Listen, Gladys, I want you to tell me something. Did you by any chance know about this peculiar technique of Royden's before you went to him?
When I asked the question, she was pouring the brandy and she hesitated, a little silky smile moving the corners of her mouth.
Damn you, Lionel, she said. You're far too clever. You never let me get away with a thing.
So, you knew?
Of course. Hermione Girdleston told me. There's still nothing wrong.
Nothing, I said. Absolutely nothing.
I could see it all quite clearly now. This Royden was indeed a bounder, practicing as neat a piece of psychological trickery as ever I'd seen. The man knew only too well that there was a whole set of wealthy, indolent women in the city who got up at noon and spent the rest of the day trying to relieve their boredom with bridge and shopping until the cocktail hour came along, while the news of an entertainment like this would spread through their ranks like smallpox.
You won't tell anyone, Lionel, will you?
No, of course not. But now I must go, Gladys, I really must.
Don't be so silly. I'm just beginning to enjoy myself. Stay till I've finished this drink, anyway.
I sat patiently on the sofa while she went on with her interminable brandy sipping. The little buried eyes were still watching me out of their corners in that mischievous, canny way, and I had a strong feeling that the woman was now hatching out some further unpleasantness or scandal. Then, suddenly, so suddenly that I jumped, she said,
"Lionel, what's this I hear about you and Janet de Pelagia?
Now, Gladys, please."
"Lionel, you're blushing."
"Nonsense.
Don't tell me the old bachelor has really taken a tumble at last.
Janet is a fine girl."
"You can hardly call her a girl."
Gladys Ponsonby paused, staring down into the large brandy glass that she held cupped in both hands.
"But, of course, I agree with you, Lionel. She's a wonderful person in every way. Except..." And now she spoke very slowly. "Except that she does say some rather peculiar things occasionally."
"What sort of things?"
"Just things, you know. Things about people. About you."
"What did she say about me?"
"Well, now, let me see. Of course, she was only joking, or I couldn't dream of telling you, but I suppose she did say how it was all a wee bit of a bore."
"What was?"
"Well, sort of going out to dinner with you nearly every night, that kind of thing."
"She said it was a bore?"
"Yes."
Gladys Ponsonby drained the brandy glass with one last big gulp, and sitting upright on the sofa began cleverly to mimic the deep tone of that voice I knew so well.
"Such a bore, my dear. Because with Lionel, one can always tell exactly what will happen. For dinner, we'll go to the Savoy Grill. Always the Savoy Grill. Then in the taxi home, he'll start burbling about how he wished he was just 20 years younger. And then at the front door, while I fish for my key, he'll stand beside me with a sort of silly spaniel look in his eyes, and I'll slowly put the key in a lock and slowly turn it, and then, very quickly, before he has time to move, I'll say good night and skip inside and shut the door behind me. Why, Lionel, what's the matter, dear? You look positively ill."
At that point, mercifully, I must have swooned clear away. I can remember practically nothing of the rest of that terrible night, except for a vague and disturbing suspicion that when I regained consciousness, I broke down completely and permitted Gladys Ponsonby to comfort me in a variety of different ways. Later,
I believe I walked out of the house and was driven home, but I remained more or less unconscious of everything about me until I woke up in my bed the following morning. I can remember with what terrifying swiftness my hatred of Janet de Pelagia began to grow. It all happened in a few minutes, a sudden, violent welling up of hatred. I tried to dismiss it, but it was on me like a fever, and in no time at all I was hunting around, as would some filthy gangster, for a method of revenge. A curious way to behave, you may say, for a man such as me. To which I would answer, no, not really, if you consider the circumstances. To my mind, this was the sort of thing that could drive a man to murder. As a matter of fact, had it not been for a small sadistic streak that caused me to seek a more subtle and painful punishment for my victim, I might well have become a murderer myself. But mere killing, I decided, was too good for this woman, and far too crude for my taste. So I began looking for a superior alternative. Fury and hate can concentrate a man's mind to an astonishing degree, and in no time at all a plot was forming and unfolding in my head, a plot so superior and exciting that I began to be quite carried away at the idea of it. The next thing I knew, I had the telephone directory in my lap and was searching eagerly for a name. I found it, picked up the phone, and dialed the number. "Hello," I said. "Mr. Royden, Mr. John Royden." Well, it wasn't difficult to persuade the man to call around and see me for a moment. I had never met him, but of course he knew my name, both as an important collector of paintings and as a person of some consequence in society. I was a big fish for him to catch. At the appointed time, he was shown into my library, and I got up to meet him. He was a small, neat man with a slightly ginger goatee beard. He wore a black velvet jacket, rust-brown tie, red pullover, and black suede shoes. I shook his small, neat hand. "Mr. Royden," I said, "I have a rather unusual request to make of you, something quite personal in its way." "Yes, Mr. Lampson?" He was sitting in the chair opposite me, and he cocked his head over to one side, quick and perky like a bird. "Of course, I know I can trust you to be discreet about anything I say." "Oh, absolutely, Mr. Lampson." "All right. Now, my proposition is this. There is a certain lady in town here whose portrait I would like you to paint. I very much want to possess a fine painting of her. But there are certain complications. For example, I have my own reasons for not wishing her to know that it is I who am commissioning the portrait. As a man of the world, I'm sure you will understand. Now, do you happen by any chance to know a lady called Janet de Pelagia?"
"I've heard of her. I couldn't exactly say I know her."
"That's a pity. It makes it a little more difficult. Do you think you could get to meet her, perhaps at a cocktail party or something like that?"
"Shouldn't be too tricky, Mr. Lampson."
"Good. Because what I suggest is this. That you go up to her and tell her she's the sort of model you've been searching for years. Then ask her if she'd mind sitting for you, free of charge. Say you'd like to do a picture of her for next year's Academy. I feel sure she'd be delighted to help you, and honoured, too, if I may say so. Then you will paint her and exhibit the picture and deliver it to me after the show is over. No one but you need know that I have bought it." He seemed to be hesitating, so I said quickly, "I'll be glad to pay you double your usual fee." That did it. The man actually licked his lips. "I should like a full-length portrait, Mr. Royden, please, and I should like her to be standing. That, to my mind, is her most graceful attitude."
"I quite understand, Mr. Lampson, and it'll be a pleasure to paint such a lovely lady."
"I expect it will," I told myself. "The way you go about it, my boy, I'm quite sure it will."
But I said, "All right, Mr. Royden, then I'll leave it all to you." When he had gone, I forced myself to sit still and take 25 deep breaths. I have never in my life felt so exhilarated. My plan was working. The most difficult part was already accomplished. There would be a wait now, a long wait. The way this man painted, it would take him several months to finish the picture. I now decided, on the spur of the moment, that it would be better if I were to go abroad in the interim. And that very next morning, after sending a message to Janet, with whom I was due to dine that night, telling her I had been called away, I left for Italy. There, as always, I had a delightful time, marred only by a constant nervous excitement caused by the thought of returning to the scene of action. I eventually arrived back 4 months later, in July, on the day after the opening of the Royal Academy, and I found to my relief that everything had gone according to plan during my absence. The picture of Janet de Pelagia had been painted and hung in the exhibition, and it was already the subject of much favourable comment both by the critics and the public. When the show was over, Royden delivered the picture to my house and received his money. I immediately had it carried up to my workroom, and with mounting excitement, I began to examine it closely. The man had painted her, standing up in a black evening dress, and there was a red plush sofa in the background. Her left hand was resting on the back of a heavy chair, also of red plush, and there was a huge crystal chandelier hanging from the ceiling. My God, I thought, what a hideous thing. Well, the portrait itself wasn't so bad. He had caught the woman's expression, the forward drop of the head, the wide blue eyes, the large, ugly, beautiful mouth with the trace of a smile in one corner. I bent forward to examine the painting of the dress. Yes, here the paint was thicker, much thicker. At this point, unable to wait another moment, I threw off my coat and prepared to go to work. I should mention here that I am myself an expert cleaner and restorer of paintings. Where my own pictures are concerned, I always do the job myself. I poured out the turpentine and added a few drops of alcohol. I dipped a small wad of cotton wool in the mixture, squeezed it out, and then gently, with a circular motion, I began to work upon the black paint of the dress. For perhaps a whole hour, I worked away on this little square of black, proceeding more and more gently as I came closer to the layer below. Then a tiny pink spot appeared, and gradually it spread and spread until the whole of my square inch was a clear, shining patch of pink. Quickly, I neutralized with pure turps. So far, so good. I knew now that the black paint could be removed without disturbing what was underneath. I worked first from the middle of her body downward, and as the lower half of her dress came away bit by bit onto my little wads of cotton wool, a queer pink undergarment began to reveal itself. I didn't for the life of me know what the thing was called, but it was a formidable apparatus constructed of what appeared to be a strong, thick, elastic material, and its purpose was apparently to contain and to compress the woman's bulging figure into a neat, streamlined shape, giving a quite false impression of slimness. Quite fantastic, the whole thing seemed to me, as I stepped back a pace to survey it. It gave me a strong sense of having somehow been cheated. For had I not, during all these past months, been admiring the sylph-like figure of this lady? She was a faker. No questions about it. But do many other females practice this sort of deception, I wondered. I knew, of course, that in the days of stays and corsets it was usual for ladies to strap themselves up. Yet for some reason I was under the impression that nowadays all they had to do was diet. When the whole of the lower half of the dress had come away, I immediately turned my attention to the upper portion, working my way slowly upward from the lady's middle. Here, around the midriff, there was an area of naked flesh. Then higher, upon the bosom itself, and actually containing it, I came upon a contrivance made of some heavy black material edged with frilly lace. This, I knew very well, was the brassiere, another formidable appliance upheld by an arrangement of black straps, as skilfully and scientifically rigged as the supporting cables of a suspension bridge. Dear me, I thought, one lives and learns. But now, at last, the job was finished, and I stepped back again to take a final look at the picture. It was truly an astonishing sight. This woman, Janet de Pelagia, almost life-size, standing there in her underwear, in a sort of drawing-room, I suppose it was, with a great chandelier above her head and a red plush chair by her side. And she herself. This was the most disturbing part of all, looking so completely unconcerned, with the wide, placid blue eyes, the faintly smiling, ugly, beautiful mouth. Also, I noticed, was something of a shock, that she was exceedingly bow-legged, like a jockey. Now, for the next and final step. Do not imagine, simply because I have not mentioned it lately, that my thirst for revenge had in any way diminished during the last few months. On the contrary, and with the last act about to be performed, I found it hard to contain myself. That night, for example, I didn't even go to bed. You see, I couldn't wait to get the invitations out. I sat up all night preparing them and addressing the envelopes. There were 22 of them in all, and I wanted each to be a personal note. The first, the most carefully phrased, was to Janet de Pelagia. In it, I regretted not having seen her for so long. I had been abroad. It was time we got together again, etc., etc. The next was to Gladys Ponsonby, then one to Lady Hermione Girdlestone, another to Princess Bikeno. It was a carefully selected list, containing, as it did, the most distinguished men, the most brilliant and influential women in the top crust of our society. At 8:30, on the evening of the 22nd, my large drawing-room was filled with people. They stood about the room, admiring the pictures, drinking their martinis, talking with loud voices. Janet de Pelagia was wearing the same black dress she had used for the portrait, and every time I caught sight of her, a kind of huge bubble vision, as in those absurd cartoons, would float up above my head, and in it I would see Janet in her underclothes, the black brassiere, the pink elastic belt that jockeys' legs. Dinner was announced, and we all moved out. "My goodness," they cried as they entered the dining room, "how dark and sinister! What divine candles! Lionel, how romantic!" There were six very thin candles set about 2 feet apart from each other down the centre of the long table. Their small flames made a little glow of light around the table itself, but left the rest of the room in darkness. It was an amusing arrangement, and apart from the fact that it suited my purpose well, it made a pleasant change. The guests soon settled themselves in their right places, and the meal began. For my part, I was watching the candles. They were so thin that I knew it would not be long before they burnt down to their bases. Also, I was mighty nervous, I will admit that, but at the same time intensely exhilarated, almost to the point of drunkenness. They were eating their strawberries when at last I decided the time had come. I took a deep breath, and in a loud voice I said, "I'm afraid we'll have to have the lights on now. The candles are nearly finished. Mary," I called. "Oh, Mary, switch on the lights, will you please?" There was a moment of silence after my announcement. I heard the maid walking over to the door, then the gentle click of the switch, and the room was flooded with a blaze of light. They all screwed up their eyes, opened them again, gazed about them. At that point, I got up from my chair and slid quietly from the room. But as I went, I saw a sight that I shall never forget as long as I live. It was Janet, with both hands in mid-air, stopped, frozen, rigid, caught in the act of gesticulating towards someone across the table. Her mouth had dropped open 2 inches, and she wore the surprised, not quite understanding look of a person who precisely 1 second before has been shot dead right through the heart. In the hall outside, I paused and listened to the beginning of the uproar, the shrill cries of the ladies and the outraged, unbelieving exclamations of the men. Then, and this was the sweetest moment of all, I heard Lord Mulheron's voice roaring above the rest. "Here, someone! Hurry! Give us some water, quick!" Out in the street, the chauffeur helped me into my car, and soon we were away from London and bowling merrily along the Great North Road towards this, my other house, which is only 95 miles from town anyway. The next 2 days I spent in gloating. I mooned around in a dream of ecstasy. It wasn't until this morning, when Gladys Ponsonby called me on the phone, that I suddenly came to my senses and realized I was not a hero at all, but an outcast. She informed me, with what I thought was just a trace of relish, that all my old and loving friends had sworn never, never to speak to me again. "Except her," she kept saying. And didn't I think it would be rather cozy if she were to come down and stay with me a few days to cheer me up? I'm afraid I was too upset by that time even to answer her politely. I put the phone down and went away to weep. Then at noon today came the final crushing blow. The post arrived, and with it, I can hardly bring myself to write about it, I'm so ashamed, came a letter, the sweetest, most tender little note imaginable, from none other than Janet de Pelagia herself. "She forgave me completely," she wrote. "She knew it was only a joke, and I must not listen to the horrid things other people were saying about me." Oh, what a cad, what a brute I felt when I read this. The more so when I found that she had actually sent me by the same post a small present as an added sign of her affection, a half-pound jar of my favourite food of all, fresh caviar. I can never, under any circumstances, resist good caviar. It is perhaps my greatest weakness. So, although I naturally had no appetite whatsoever for food at dinner time this evening, I must confess I took a few spoonfuls of the stuff in an effort to console myself in my misery. It is even possible that I took a shade too much, because I haven't been feeling any too chipper this last hour or so. Perhaps I ought to go up right away and get myself some bicarbonate of soda. I can easily come back and finish this later, when I'm in better trim. You know, now I come to think of it, I really do feel rather ill all of a sudden.